How are you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very, very good. I'm doing very well. Thank you. Well, this week I thought we'd talk about, a provocative topic, an interesting topic, to say the least. The question, is America under Talmudic law, and why are we worrying about Sharia law? That was an article written by Michael Hoffman that I sent to you. But it also I sent you a video, a YouTube video from TrueStream Media, Aaron and Melissa Dykes, and it detailed how a Hurricane Harvey repair grant and application and agreement. I think this is for the city of Dickinson, Texas. Has a clause in there. It's verification not to boycott Israel. That's a clause. Well, you have to somehow verify that you somehow either not taking part in, not participating in, or maybe just you don't support the BDS movement, which is the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement targeting the state of Israel for its treatment, many crimes vis-a-vis the Palestinian people, the occupation there. And now as a condition, supposedly, for receiving this grant money, which I understand is actually private donations that are administered by the city, you have to swear, more or less swear an allegiance to the state of Israel, I suppose. How do you want to go with this?
Well, where can one go? I mean, it's just
chutzpah? Insane. Is this chutzpah? No.
So, Dickinson, they had, I guess, a prior law, which was a Texas state law that was passed in May. And there was no publicity. It just somehow got passed. And it required all contractors to certify they are not participating in the boycott of Israel. So this is not just a Dickinson, kind of crazy small town. I mean, like maybe they got LSD in the water or something. I mean, this is a Texas state law. And so basically what has happened is that the Israeli lobby were able to get the Texan state legislature and governor to agree that contractors to get any kind of state money, and this I don't have clarity on because I don't know where to get it, but I will eventually. But they can't get it if they participate in any kind of boycott of Israel. Now, okay, first of all, this is obviously a violation of the First Amendment, wouldn't you say?
I think it's a slight infraction.
Yeah.
It's an infringement, as to say. It is an infringement.
Well, I mean, how can we have the right to? The First Amendment has always protected both the freedom of speech and the freedom of association. I mean, even hate speech, right, is protected without exception.
Particularly political speech.
And political speech, yeah. Right? So this Texan law simply. I think the correct way to look at it is it's an erosion of the Constitution. I mean, it's sort of like the events after 9/11, where the Constitution started to shrink. Here, the First Amendment now is gone. Now, this is a very kind of slow erosion of the First Amendment. And I will say, in checking with it, it turns out that Dickinson doesn't really do some kind of scrutiny. In other words, as far as I can tell, they aren't, demanding like some kind of investigation in terms of this. But the law is there, and when you apply for the grant, you are agreeing that, you will not boycott and are not boycotting Israel. So this, I have to say, is probably coming from the same sort of influence that is being wielded by people like John Hagee. Now, he's an evangelical Christian minister, Cornerstone Church, and he basically takes this kind of bizarre interpretation of the Bible that the Jews are the chosen one. And then he asks that his parishioners support the expulsion of the Palestinians, and he actually funds Israeli settlements. Now, this guy is such a powerhouse that presidential candidates, Republican presidential candidates, will routinely visit his little bizarre congregation.
Yeah, he is a Christian Zionist.
He is a Christian Zionist par excellence.
So, which is a creation of the Schofield Bible that the Zionists had written in the early 20th century to produce this very situation.
Exactly. Yeah. This, and you see, we did the show which outlined sort of the history of Zionism from Lord Palmerston through basically the creation of the Nazi Party and anti-Semitism. You know, it's this long process that Masonry and Zionist organizations engaged in. And one of the elements was the Schofield Bible, which has a translation that emphasizes basically the chosen people status of the Jews, and also that we won't get Jesus to return until we've basically had these wars in the Middle East. So the idea being is that the wars in the Middle East, to this fundamental perspective, is a good or good things. So you know, the this guy's name is Byron Millward, and he's the Dickinson assistant manager. If people want to make comments, you know, to our elected representative, he would be the guy. And he says that, okay, he says that, you know, we do require that they certify, but this guy emphasized that they're not performing background checks on the political views. So thank heaven for that. Is that comforting?
That's decent of him. Very mighty decent of you, fella.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so, I'm saying is you're in jeopardy there if you do sign this contract.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it's going to, you know, restrict your activity if you don't really sign that. Yeah.
So the first question I have is that, okay, well, what if instead of Israel, what if it had been, I don't know, Iran, right? We cannot participate in any boycotts of Iran. What do you think would have been the result, both in the media and the political class, Tim?
Oh, I think I would have heard some commentary on Fox News.
Yeah.
On Sean Hannity's show.
Like, people are so worried about Sharia law, right? I mean, I've heard Newt Gingrich, that Masonic cesspool, I've heard him say that he's very worried about Sharia law in the United States, right? That they will overwhelm us somehow and we'll end up under Sharia law. And this, of course, goes right along with his promotion of the Middle East wars, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have to worry about the Sharia law. But, gee, I've never heard anybody say we have to worry about Talmudic law. How come, Tim? I mean, isn't that, I mean, here you actually have an example of an encroachment of the First Amendment by, and I think Israel can be basically, you know, allied with Talmudic influence. Why isn't there any sort of hue and cry from either the media or the political class?
Well, I think the answer could be told, was told by Voltaire so many centuries ago, who said, do you want to find out who rules over you? Find out who you are not able to or allowed to criticize. And of course, he never criticized Freemasonry or the Jews.
Right.
So, I mean, so an agent himself, a Freemason, agent of Freemasonry himself, at least according to what's his name? Forget who he said he probably was a Whig agent. He gave a little bit of truth there. So we have a situation. I think all 50 U.S. governors have signed resolutions condemning the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against Israel. All of them. New York, right. North Carolina, Michigan, Kansas have laws on the books, which I think are probably similar to Texas law, where they're not performing background checks, but it's designed to have a chilling effect and also have a broad cultural effect. Basically, this is just accepted as normal. And there's some talk in New York of the state actually collecting a blacklist of companies that have supported the boycott movement.
Yeah, I've heard that, and that is really troubling. Yeah. And you know, another thing, Tim, that is really troubling to me is that Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post, the premier Israeli newspapers, both of them covered the story in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
They had headlines stating that Texas town says no hurricane relief if you boycott Israel.
This is similar to the idea of, you know, laws in more than a dozen Western free countries, laws that criminally prosecute people who question aspects of the Holocaust narrative.
Yeah, for example, in Germany.
Yeah, Germany, yeah.
Right. So the question about, you know, do we need to be worried about Talmudic law? I think that question is sort of broad. I would think that the first question is a little more specific, which is just that, is there an undemocratic aspect to the influence that Zionists have in the United States? Right. The next question is that it's simply about Jews. Do Jews have too much political power relative to their numbers? And the reason why the questions are appropriate is that if you don't have enough political power for your numbers, then we step in, right? You get, like, if the blacks are not represented, mm-hmm. You know, you'll have laws created. Affirmative action steps in, right? If that's basically the law of the land, it would seem to me that a group having way more representation than its democratic number indicates would also be something that would be at issue. And again, I just don't ever see this question brought up.
Well, because it is sort of a Talmudic principle that if you question Jewish hegemony or Jewish power, you are by definition an anti-Semite and a Nazi, and therefore a war criminal, and therefore not deserving of due process or of civil rights, freedom of speech, and these things. That's sort of the mind control or psychological warfare that has been waged on the public mind, so to speak, for the past 60, 70 years. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what it is. We've been denied the very language to articulate these concerns. Polite society has created a canon of acceptable thought that we have to adhere to, lest we don't get invited to parties, we get expelled from school, we lose our tenure, we get fired, we suffer some sort of expulsion from polite society, and our ability to earn a decent living is lost. So this has a chilling effect. This is, in the 1950s, the American Jewish Committee developed a strategy called dynamic silence, that it used Jewish financial power working behind the scenes to boycott those voices that were critical of things like the founding of the State of Israel, what was going on at that time, the expulsion and eradication of the Palestinians from the territory that was stolen from them in 1948. If you were a public voice, no matter how prominent you were, if you came out against the founding of Israel and the subsequent policies that were that the government followed, you suffered dynamic silence. You were boycotted. You found yourself losing your column if you're a journalist, or your radio show if you're a radio personality. There is a case that Alison Ware details in her book Against Our Better Judgment, which is a book very critical of that period. It highlights or details secretive Zionist Jewish influence within the U.S. government dating back to the turn of the century, the Balfour Declaration, Louis Brandeis, and these things, how their Zionist or Jewish intrigue led to the United States recognizing Israel in 1948 when Truman was president. But she did details a case of a woman journalist named Dorothy Thompson, who was very prominent in her age. I mean, anything that the feminists would promote, because she was a woman journalist on her own, and she had a radio program, a nationally syndicated column. And she, in the 1940s, in the late 30s, she was very critical of the Third Reich and the policies of Nazi Germany, and supportive of the war effort, and very sympathetic towards the Jews. She she had taken in the Holocaust narrative and all the stories, and she was very sympathetic to the plight. But then she noticed the founding of Israel, this horrible treatment on part of the Palestinians, and she started being very critical of how they were being treated at the hands of the Jewish state, which was at that time, you could call them terrorists, because Irgun and the Israeli Defense Force was Haganah. These are all Jewish terrorist organizations that were able to seize the land by going in and carrying out a bunch of massacres and chasing out the 750,000-800,000 people that happened to inhabit the territory at the time. So she was critical of this. All of a sudden, she found her career fell apart. She lost her column, lost her radio show, and this, she was a target of dynamic silence. This sort of this behind-the-scenes Jewish conspiracy to undermine the careers of those people who have the temerity to question, the claims of the Israeli state or of Zionism.
Right, and it seems to me that the U.S. just public in general needs to really start to understand that. I don't want to use conspiracy as a term, Tim.
Okay.
But I am going to say that there is a kind of organizational aspect that many Jewish people have basically entered into, which enables them to be, let's just, to use an expression, like a permanent deep state, right? Mm-hmm. That these organizations, like AIPAC and
ADL.
ADL and
Benai
B'rith. I mean, okay, so they are organized and they support one another, and then you have their influence focused, right? They know how to focus their influence, and that's why I'm really glad you brought up that example. What was her lady's name again?
Dorothy Thompson.
I'd never heard of her, which shows how effective the.
Well, there you go. I didn't either until I read their account, and she was very prominent in her day, and that she's been erased from the history books. She's a non-person now, more or less. Right. Ordinarily, women should hear about this. The feminists who promote all this, having a career, and we don't hear about someone like that because that would open up a can of worms, I guess.
Well, yeah, and they might have a reaction that would be the opposite of what they're hoping to have, mm-hmm. which is to create silence. Then there might be some anger, and people would say, "Wait a second, she was basically silenced for political reasons. She represents our First Amendment, right?" And that's the thing that I I think that the case that influence that has a Jewish basis. And now, incidentally, do not, the idea of anti-Semitism is not something that I want to even entertain as coherent here. We're not talking about everybody who's a Semite. What we're talking about is these financially organized political...
Which would include the Palestinians, by the way. So.
Well, exactly. If you want to go into the Semites. But the thing is that they are... As a political, these organizations, as a political, focus, are simply undemocratic. Mm-hmm. It would be as if, white Christians organized themselves into groups and then took these exact same principles and techniques and started to apply them to black authors, right? Mm-hmm. It would just be transparent. This is a violation of the First Amendment, right? But somehow, the way that these organizations can be so effective is because they're never actually exposed, it seems to me,
And if your point out the organizational aspect, you're engaged in this wild, you know, this crazy, not crazy, but evil, you know, all, you know, centuries long history of blaming the Jews, you know. You're blaming the Jews. You're pointing out Jewish organizations. Well, the Jewish people are a political entity. Okay, they organize, they identify collectively, and they organize collectively. And when they do, those organizations should be held to standards and should be open to criticism when they're advocating certain policies. And so, I mean, the psychological warfare trick is that, oh, you're an anti-Semite because you're pointing out the intrigues of AIPAC or ADL going, the character assassination is carried about the Anti-Defamation League or the torture, you know, of the Israeli Defense Force or the activities of the Mossad or, you know, something, you know. So, no, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's on its face ridiculous. And that's why I think a lot of the anti-Semite charge has lost its sting now, because most people just roll their eyes and they don't back down out of moral concern. They roll back down out of cowardice or fear.
That's right. Yeah, the moral structure, I think, is completely collapsed.
Yeah.
And people are just intimidated. And let me tell you something. It looks like what you're looking at is a process that's going to get a lot worse. And that's why the question, you know, that we asked at the beginning of the show is not just theoretical. In the July 19th edition, 2017, of New York Magazine, Eric Levitz wrote an article entitled, 43 Senators Want to Make It a Federal Crime to Boycott Israeli Settlements.
Settlements. I mean, that's in violation of the UN recognition of Israel, these settlements.
Well, it's a violation exactly of the... of what which is regarded by international law as a military occupation that's illegal, and yet to make a political stance against it, just an obvious First Amendment stance, that I want to boycott basically the settlements, this would become a federal crime. You see, this is really terrifying to me.
Don't these senators, when they take office, swear an oath to uphold and defend the U.S. Constitution?
What the hell happened to the oath?
Well, I mean, obviously, at this point, it's a little pinkwent to point that out.
I guess there's except when it comes to Israel.
A good example. Remember when Barack Obama, a couple of years ago, he came out and he said he supports a return to the original borders, the 1948 borders. Of course, this would contradict or this would challenge the Greater Israel Project, which is the Likud agenda, the party that controls Israel right now, Benjamin Netanyahu. The next day, Benjamin Netanyahu comes to Washington, D.C., addresses the Congress, and gets 29 standing ovations. A foreign leader. 29 standing ovations. The reason why that occurs is because most of those congressional creatures either blackmailed or bribed to do that.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
This is the thing. When they gave him the 29 standing ovations, and remember, Netanyahu, at the very best is a kind of controversial political figure. I mean, the idea that there is no, I mean, that he's somehow, you know, kind of like a George Washington or someone, you know, Nelson Mandela, someone who can just be seen almost universally.
Yeah. Mother Teresa.
I mean, that is just ridiculous. Yeah. Here's someone who is really, at the very best, very controversial. And to give that kind of accolades to him really basically cheapened the representative power of our elected representatives, right? Because it looked like, well, they're just in thrall of this guy. And that's why I really would like to have another law created, which is that the actual financial relationships to political entities, right, be much more visible to citizens. People say, oh, you can get the data if you want it. Yeah, try to get it.
Who reports it?
Who reports it? Where do I get the data of these 43 senators' financial relationships to Israel and to Jewish supporters of Israel? Where's the cross-referencing? Where are the data that would make me as a citizen have a coherent understanding of the financial aspect of the 43 senators to this political question?
Well, look at AIPAC itself, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, Okay, they're not forced to they're not required to register as a foreign agent. Now this is interesting because I think they're the successor they're the ancestor to the American Zionist Council, the organization that John F. Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy were seeking to have registered as a foreign agent in the early 60s, and you know how that turned out.
Didn't turn out too well.
for John and eventually even Bobby. Either one.
Yeah. Well, to correlate, but it definitely nothing turned out well for them, and these efforts just fell by the board. So,
I mean, you have all this stuff about Russia and the election, all this stuff, right? But there's 800-pound gorilla, Israeli gorilla, sitting in the room.
Exactly. I mean, the Russian influence on Twitter and all these kind of vague, who knows what's going on. And yet here you have 43 senators wanting to make it a federal crime to exercise your First Amendment right.
Dual citizens in charge of the Pentagon, the State Department, and not to mention maybe on the Supreme Court. I mean, this is the problem we have here.
Yeah, so that's why the question is really quite real, because, okay, look at it from the other perspective. I mean, let's just say it does exist. Let's just say, okay, so there's like a Zionist organization in the U.S. that wants to work with Israel to basically turn the United States into a legal vassal of the Israeli nation. There's a question. What would it look like? How would it proceed? Aren't some of the things that we are discussing right now would be steps and elements in the process?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think a week or so ago we talked about Freemasonry and the British Empire, and its relation into Zionism, and there's connection here, which is very interesting. It can be very confusing because it's a question of is a dog wagging the tail or the tail. The tail now wagging the dog. But there was a time in the 1930s, the first half of the 20th century, when British influence played a big part in suborning and more or less getting control of the U.S. government for the benefit of the British Empire. Now, factored in there was also Zionist interest, which we talked about. The British Zionist Zio complex, more or less. But I'm saying actually, it's kind of funny because those who did point out British influence in, say, around 1940 were smeared as anti-Semitic because they didn't support a war against Germany, like people like Charles Lindbergh and the American First Committee. So this isn't the first thing. I mean, foreign governments coming in and having influence, particularly the British, because of their connections to the to Eastern Seaboard elite and the financial in Wall Street. And we have a similar situation now with Israel, just that perhaps the Israeli tail has begun to wag the British dog now.
Well, we don't know because, that's one of the problems with secret societies is that we don't really know what's inside them. I have said many times, we need just a whole DNA database, particularly on powerful secret society members and influential Jewish individuals. We need to clean this up so we understand what's going on. I mean, the relationship between British Freemasonry and the creation of Israel is very direct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you look at the southern border of Israel, if you were coming from Egypt, you have basically a gigantic, but a representation of the pyramid with the all-seeing eye.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When you go to the sort of the head supreme judicial complex, which was created by the Rothschilds, and I believe it's in Jerusalem, but you'll see that the all-seeing eye is represented almost everywhere.
And right? You have, of course, the flag has the two rivers, and the double, pyramids that's formed the Star of David.
So,
yeah,
exactly right. So you ask, well, what is the actual relationship? To me, when we ask about, this process whereby the constitutional powers of the citizens are being eroded, and it looks like it's becoming more concrete and more visible, it may be that you're just being revealed what is already in existence.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there is a connection between Masonry and groups that are basically overtly Jewish, if there is a connection, a cooperation, right, then you're already at kind of a slave state condition. You just don't know it. Because when you look at the influence of Masons and Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove and the secret societies, and then you add to that the political influence of groups that are identifying with Israel or Judaism in general, well, you pretty much have almost all the political power in existence in the United States anyway, right?
Yep.
I mean, look at the Pentagon during September 11th, 2001. You have dual citizens, Zionists, and Masons. I mean, this is basically, the Skull and Bones is, of course, the president of the United States. I mean, this, for the citizen, the American citizen, is pretty negative, right? Because we just don't have any, we can't be sure we're having any real representation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's in back of these secret societies. I mean, when you look at 9-1-1, you can see, in my opinion, you can see it's very clear that there is a secret society. It is malevolent. It's willing to kill citizens, right? And it sure has some kind of connection with Israel. Remember the dancing Israelis, and then when you get Lucky Larry Silverstein, and the collection of Jewish Americans. I mean, how does this organization stay in existence? What binds these groups together?
You have the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which is run by a cabal of the Zionist criminals, which now, of course, that's the Kirshner, which is the Donald Trump's son-in-law.
Yeah.
The influence runs deep, and you have all the business dealings, the Jewish gangsters. We profited mightily from those events. But I guess to point out those connections as being at least a legitimate avenue for investigation would label you a...
Anti-Semite.
Anti-Semite, yeah. So
yeah.
You can't go there, I guess. And I guess Donald Trump even calls them dancing Arabs, right? Dancing Middle Eastern guys.
Is that what he says? He is a dancing Middle East guy. He goes to Saudi Arabia and he does the sword dance with those. Mm-hmm. This was the guy who was going to drain the swamp. So it's it isn't just a problem. It is the problem. I mean, if you really think about why the lives of the common American are, getting worse, why European Americans' life expectancy is shorter now. It's definitely related to this issue because the political system just isn't working for us. It just isn't working for us. And so when you see, but power is, it's a zero sum game. The power that this organization has, that this combination of the Christian Zionists and the Israeli lobby and the American Jewish financial interest, the power that they have is power that could belong to other groups. And it isn't. There, because they have it. So we are suffering. Our status is diminishing. And yet when we look over here, we see, gee whiz, we can't even boycott Israel. We can't make a political statement against it, or we lose this financial benefit that would be available to all other citizens. So what can I say except... it's time to basically change course. We have to do it. We have to recognize that, they have political and psychological power, but too damn bad. I mean, because look, Tim, where is this heading?
Well, I think, we're supposed to love our enemies, but acknowledge that they exist. We're not supposed to deny they exist, right?
Right.
So, I mean, this may be a good time to segue into the article that Michael Hoffman wrote, Is America Under Talmudic Law, Not Sharia Law? Because this, he addresses sort of the broader historical or cultural trends that have been going on for the better part of a century in the West, particularly here in the United States. And if you look at the sort of the moral corruption, subversion that has occurred in the United States, obviously the Jewish community, Jewish organizations have played a big part in that. you know, their activism, their cultural aggression against what, you know, Christian society, Christian mores and values.
Like Hollywood.
Like Hollywood, yes. Yeah. Yeah. You know, but he points out in his article, he says, America's under Talmudic law, not Sharia law. He just points out things like, oh, things that we kind of accept today, part of, you know, sort of our occulted, mysterious banking system, financial system with usury, how that's been had been gradually accepted. It had been rejected by the West for the better part of 1,500 years by the Catholic Church. And then, I guess, during the Renaissance, it became gradually accepted by various Renaissance popes. Of course, the Renaissance popes are notorious for their corruption. But this occurred, at least how I understand the history, was usury or debt always follows along with debasement, monetary debasement. And it was the Venetian banking families that brought in the Jewish financiers to offer debt or usury to make up for the fact that they were in the process of debasing the wages of the working man in Venice. So they've always worked with other, I guess you can say, they've always worked with non-Jewish, bankers or kings or monarchs to screw the people over, I guess you could say. But gradually they've accepted usury, which then, if you wonder why life is getting harder, well, it's called compound interest.
Exactly right. No, something we should do a show on this, because I think it's just absolutely America 101. People need to understand this, such a simple concept, that the primary banks are charged a very low interest rate for money that the Federal Reserve, for the credit that the Federal Reserve creates for them. Mm-hmm. They then can resell the credit. Mm-hmm. But the Federal Reserve had no cost, zero, right? The primary bank has no cost of the credit. They are then able to sell to you at an interest rate of whatever, something that came out of thin air.
This is monetized debt.
Right.
Which is worse than just debt. Yeah, it's monetized debt.
And now you say, well, that you say that whenever this occurs, there's going to be debasement. Well, because it's like night follows day. Mm-hmm. When you can create out of thin air something, that something will eventually be worth nothing. Mm-hmm. You see, it'll reflect the cost of production. And so the debt system works until it collapses, which our dollar certainly is going to.
And monetary debasement always creates cultural debasement.
Exactly. And then, well, of course, because once you have monetary debasement, see what happens, of course, is that the money that's this invented money that has no basis in labor, are no basis in anything that's real. And so you end up with unreal wealth.
Now, Joe, valuing labor is a German concept, and now you're being a Nazi.
I know. Hey, I just can't help it. I just go back to my horrible self almost every single time if left alone. And that's just what I see is that, we have, this system now where basically the credit cycle is nearing the end, and that's when you get the worst cultural debasement. A lot of the people involved in this process were not Jewish, rest assured, mm-hmm. but a lot were. And the Federal Reserve and the control of the primary banks is extraordinarily, very large fraction are Jewish individuals or companies that have relations to them. And so it's just a very legitimate question in the zero-sum game of political power for Europeans, Gentiles, to ask, well, are we just getting screwed,
Well, this is what the Talmud calls for, though.
Right. The Talmud, it's a slippery thing. You know, the a lot of the passages in the Talmud, which are used to denote its anti-Semitism, overt anti-Semitism. The fact is that there are other translations that are possible. Mm-hmm. And so people focus on the Talmud with the idea that, you're going to get clarity in the language of basically kind of an anti-Gentilism, anti-Goyimism. Mm-hmm. But even the term goyim, you know, is one of these hard to completely, you can use it in different ways. And that's how the language is. It enables them basically to be just as racist as they want. And then say, oh, I didn't mean that. You're misunderstanding. You know, you don't understand Hebrew. It's too complicated for it. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, I always try to, you know, focus it. I think it's a little easier to just, there are passages in concerning the chosen people, the way that the Old Testament is structured, which I think are clearer for people to understand. I mean, the Old Testament has a very strong racial bias against non-Jews. Mm-hmm. They get slaughtered all over the place. They get enslaved. You know, you have the burden of Jerusalem, Kipling's secret poem, which I think you and I have discussed. But, you know, it recites a passage in the Old Testament where Sarah slaps her slave around, and this is seen as righteous. Now, that's, you know, this isn't a good cultural foundation for international relations. You know what I'm saying?
No.
So the thing is, yeah, because slavery really is something that people would want to resist, I would think. And also, you know, to point out that it's morally wrong. So you shouldn't have literature that really glorifies it, but there it is right in the Old Testament. And so this kind of misunderstanding of the racial component of the religion is amplified when you get crackpots like John Hagee, then, who take this relationship between the character Jesus Christ to a sort of fundamental position, particularly we're using the Scofield Bible, that translation. And then they say, well, look, this is just how the world's supposed to be. They are the chosen people. You should have greater Israel. All the Muslims need to be destroyed. And don't worry, Jesus is going to come back to earth. You know, so we've got a lot of work to do, because that group, you know, the Christian Zionists, are probably the most misguided humans on the planet, the most deeply confused people imaginable. This is confusion squared, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got bad preachers and a very bad translation and just a horrible misunderstanding of the world and history. And yet they you know, are using their faith as the foundation for all this. And so it's a real problem. But we're going to have to find a way to break this apart, Tim, because, you know, when you look at the magazine article, New York Magazine article, July 19th, you know, it's getting to the point where they're almost unafraid, basically, of shattering the Constitution.
Yeah.
You know?
It's the quickening, or some sort of coming out party or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a coming out party of a racial hegemony. Mm-hmm. Because if that article had said that 43 senators want to make it a federal crime to boycott Saudi Arabia, boy, oh boy, could you imagine the hue and cry?
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine?
I think we should probably look for a historical perspective. The Talmud itself is just a series of many, many debates between rabbis that was codified in the 7th century A.D. This is the post-Temple Judaism.
Most of it is that. There are some historical passages, okay. but by and large, that's what it is. Yeah.
This is Talmudic Judaism, which some say fundamentally changed. It isn't really the biblical Judaism. That's what some people say. You know, I'm not an expert on that, so I'm not going to debate that. That's what some people say. But there was an interesting, humorous account. Is the Catholic Church wasn't aware of the Talmud until the 12th or 13th century. I think it was under Gregory the Ninth, Pope Gregory the Ninth, that they first got aware of it and investigated it. And they had a committee, and they invited a rabbi to come to the Vatican and defend the Talmud. And I think, in June 1240, Nicholas Donen had extended debate with Rabbi Yahiel, Ben Joseph of Paris, under royal auspices, and presided over the Queen Mother Blanche de of Castile. One Jewish commentator claims the entire event epitomized the declining status of Jews in that century and the transformation in Christian minds into little more than embodiments of a blasphemous doctrine. The rabbi was dumbfounded that he had had to defend Jewish esoteric writings in a hostile environment. Nothing like this had ever happened before. Rabbi Yehiel, lacking any precedent for conducting a disputation of this sort, didn't know how to respond. When asked whether it was true that the Talmud claimed Jesus was condemned to an eternity in hell, immersed in boiling excrement, and Mary, his mother, was a whore, the rabbi could only respond, yes, those passages were in the Talmud, but they did not refer to that Jesus or that Mary. Not every Louis born in France is the king of France. Yehiel maintained giving new meaning to the term chutzpah. Has it not happened, he claimed, that two men were born in the same city, had the same name, and died in the same manner? There are many such cases. One Jewish historian referred to Rabbi Yehiel's denial as the birth of Jewish humor. A Christian account of the debate, however, failed to see the humor in his statement. Concerning this Jesus, he confessed that he was born out of adultery and that he is punished to hell and born in the excrement and that he lived at the time of Titus. But the Rabbi Yehiel said this Jesus is different from our Jesus, however, is unable to say who he was, whence it is clear that he died. Well, that's in the E. Michael Jones' book.
That's very amusing.
So I just, you know, it's the Talmud, they didn't know it existed, but it's right. very important because the Talmud, it's been described to me as a method to maintain rabbinical tyranny of the Jewish people. To point out, we are also acknowledging that the victims of this are millions and millions of Jews themselves. It's a psychological warfare. They're entrapped. And I think it was it was Trotsky himself that said the Talmud is there to incite pogroms to maintain group cohesion under rabbinical rule. That's Leon Trotsky acknowledged that. And so that's the Talmud is there to encourage this attitude, encourage certain types of behavior. And although the vast majority of Jews know very little of the Talmud, apparently it's like 30 volumes of just incomprehensible back and forth debates.
Huge. Yeah, it's completely enormous. Yeah.
But they internalize enough of it that you can see this. The Talmud encourages certain behavior among the Jewish rank and file, perhaps to maintain that group cohesion, also to get the reaction. You know,
this would be an interesting kind of fact finding mission, because I talk to a lot of Jewish scholars and also just Jewish individuals about this, and I am always amazed at how little of the Talmud that they know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll cite just a few stories in the Talmud. What are you talking about? They haven't even a clue. So I don't think that a lot of these guys are getting much influence from it. I think that, you know, young men for a period of time would have a little bit of training in it. But the problem is the people that it really influences are the rabbis.
Mm-hmm.
And the rabbis do, particularly the fundamental rabbis, do basically go through the Talmud closely and know all of the stories. And they would actually have the occulted understanding of it, which I think is really, really black.
Mm-hmm. In my opinion. Yeah.
I mean, again, like I say, the language is very slippery, but and I don't get invited to the parties. But if I had to bet, I would say that it is just racist in the extreme.
I mean, you and I both have pointed out how there's a tendency, a strong revolutionary streak within the Jewish community. Jews tend to be the vanguard leaders of subversive revolutionary movements, be it political, cultural, moral. Hollywood, that the Jews are very prominent in promoting things like pornography, abortion, sexual revolution. Of course, we talk about Wilhelm Reich, you know, and of course and you've mentioned the Hungarian character
Gregor Lukacs, right? Yeah,
who were doing this prior to the Second World War in the 1920s. So you can't blame it on Hitler, as I like to blame Hitler all the time for these or. As an excuse for this stuff. But the American Jewish Committee came out with the authoritarian personality. And what it is, they more or less pathologized normal, healthy behavior. That was sort of routine among particularly the Christian majority, and pathologized, particularly the strong father figure, and saw that as sort of a it would create, this was the germ of fascism. So you needed to break up, weaken the father, break up the family. And then they used various Jewish, I guess you could say, elements within the entertainment community, governmental, educational, then the cultural Marxists that had come over after the 1930s started to implement this agenda. You saw it, you know, they infested the universities. You see it in entertainment.
Herbert Marcuse. Marcuse was a Frankfurt School guy. He worked somehow in the OSS. He was completely intellectually aligned with the American Jewish Committee's production of authoritarian personality. And then he comes out with, of all things, Eros and Civilization, which is a 100% conclusion of the or an action based upon the conclusion of the authoritarian personality, which calls for these psychological basically controls to be placed against American culture that use Eros, mm-hmm. right? That sex, drugs, and rock and roll to break apart the things that could potentially create what we see as fascism. And then Marcuse comes out with Eros and Civilization, where he talks about polysexualism being a great thing and don't worry about the personal hygiene, right? Mm-hmm. It's a user manual for the hippies. And so this is all, you know, I mean, when you talk about the revolutionary spirit, I mean, that's, the, in my opinion, the correct way to understand it. I mean, these people saw themselves in a kind of racial struggle and used techniques basically to their advantage, psychological techniques. It's not very hard to understand. In fact, it's really, you know, I mean, people that I talk to, they say, well, people are Jewish that I bring these points up. They go, well, if you were in our shoes, you'd have done the same thing. Well, I don't know about that, but I know one thing. I know that in our shoes, we should do the same thing.
But at least the kind of response
to defend ourselves.
But then they are conceding your point.
Oh yeah.
Of course. I mean, you're acknowledging this. Okay.
Well, this is an amazing thing. If you ever, and I've had this kind of conversation so many times that I'm always shocked by it, but when you get into a discussion about cultural debasement of America by Jewish people with a Jew, right? You go, you know, look at all these guys, and you've got the Frankfurt School, and you've got this, and you've got all these psychologists and stuff. And they go, yeah, that all makes sense. But they don't see any moral qualms about it. They just think, yeah, it's sort of like the same. You see, this is, to me, the conclusion of the authoritarian personality should be read by every single European. Mm-hmm. Every single, we should just sit there and understand. Because they're actually saying, without any equivocation, they go, you know, we need to like combine all of our psychological sciences into a kind of propaganda to implement what we think is our best path here in this culture for us. So they're saying, and they actually use the term propaganda. So what they're saying is, we will use mind control mm-hmm. against people's will. We will not be telling them that we're doing this. This is what they're saying, just flat out. We're going to use these psychological principles. They won't know we're doing it, and we're going to bend culture into the way we want. So when you now come to the subject that we're talking about today, the question is this the same thing? I mean, are we still, now are we getting to the legal structure where, you know, the psychological influence has led to a situation where they can now say, well, let's just go forward and make sure the laws control them as well.
Well, it's funny because in the article that I cited that Michael Hoffman wrote, he cites various examples of Talmudic law being implemented into American law via judicial activism, which is Talmudic, law of the judges. There's no legislature. And that's what he points out, which is interesting to say the least. But things like pornography being promoted via judicial activism, like the Roth decision, abortion, of course, Roe v. Wade, that's also part of the Talmud, contraception, which is more of a Protestant thing, so you have all this being promoted. Gay marriage, the courts did this. This wasn't being passed by popular demand of the legislature. It required the courts to step in and impose a rather novel interpretation of the 14th Amendment, at least in my estimation.
Yeah,
you know, it's ridiculous. They're not. These things aren't popular, but the thing is, they get it passed to the courts, and then they flex their cultural muscle through the media, entertainment, news, to make it seem like all of a sudden this stuff was popular. So 5 years ago, if you promote such a thing, you'd be considered a crackpot and a weirdo. Now, if you oppose such a thing, you're considered a crackpot and a weirdo. I mean, it's yeah. I mean, it's astonishing. It's amazing.
The dynamic silence is getting more dynamic
as
time goes along. And they're able to shut down and intimidate the European faster and faster on more and more issues, you know, because the people are just getting used to it. You know, so
recently with this guy, Mark Faber, who's a financial guy.
Yeah.
And he just made the simple observation that America became a rich and relative free nation because it was populated by Europeans. And
right.
He's also true about the world. Now, when we talk about the conquest of North America by Europeans and also in Western imperialism, it's a complicated subject. There's not one way you can use to explain it because it means so many things to so many different people at different times. But the reality is, for the most part, whatever advantages there are to the modern world, you know, whether it's law, infrastructure, they were introduced to many of these peoples via imperialism, through Western colonization, expansion of European civilization. I know it isn't a clean slate, but to the extent that we do acknowledge Western morality, human rights, human dignity, modern accoutrements like infrastructure, you know, hygiene, these things were Western developments. He makes that acknowledgement, and he's forced to resign from the TV show, from the board of his company. But if you were to, by the very standards people use to condemn Western civilization, they don't apply them to their own, to non-Western civilizations, like human sacrifice or you know, slavery, which was ubiquitous, these things. It's only against European civilization that these standards are used to condemn it.
And there's, yeah, I mean, it's part of critical theory.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all...
Yeah, exactly. Critical theory, which is...
The Frankfurt School, they worked all this out. I mean... Yeah. I mean, so what they determined was that if they just attack every single aspect of European culture, and particularly they saw that racism was something that you know, was kind of intellectually vulnerable, that they could, if they gained enough political and sort of stature in these institutions, they could just browbeat people into basically losing, ethnic pride. Which would then enable them to basically be easily to control. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, that's just sort of the general plan. That's really kind of what's going on. When you look at Gregor Luchas, you know, during the Hungarian Soviet, so he gets control. They get control of this group of Europeans. You have Bela Kun. His real name is Kohn. And you have Gregor Lukas, his real name is like Lowenstein, I think. They're mm-hmm. two Jews, right? So they have control over the Hungarian people, and they go, well, you know, we're going to implement some education here. The first phase is basically a kind of Herbert Marcusean polysexualism for children, mm-hmm. right? And then the second thing they do is kids will need to go in the afternoons to these fairy tale conventions where we will give them fairy tales and read this stuff to them so they can even lose their identity as humans. I mean, mm-hmm. not making this stuff up. This is their own language, right? Now, this is pre-Holocaust, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is, now, you have to ask yourself, these ideas are so crackpot, are so completely insane. How can they reflect anything other than basically a cultural attack? They don't make sense in any other context.
Yes.
And there's just no sense to them. So this then becomes the Frankfurt School. It becomes critical theory. It becomes the American Jewish Committee's authoritarian personality. And then on we go into modern American culture. Well, now you're getting this, First Amendment is no longer in existence.
And you mentioned the destruction of ethnic pride or identity being key to this, because that's very important, because we saw in the United States, we've mentioned, talked about this before, the destruction of the ethnic neighborhoods, the destruction of ethnic identity. Destruction of those neighborhoods is key to destroying the ethnic, particularly Catholic identity, which is important to homogenizing American culture, creating white culture, for part of the America's, you know, imperial objective of the, you know, Henry Luce's you know, American century. But this is a part of a broader thing, because one thing I read is reading about the Talmud, and it says one of the World Jewish Council announced in 1883, the great ideal of Judaism is that while the whole world shall be imbued with Jewish teaching, and that in universal, the great ideal of Judaism is that the whole world will be imbued with Jewish teaching, and that in a universal brotherhood of nation. So basically a greater Jewish identity for the whole world. Now, that sounds awfully like New World Order Freemasonry, if you ask me.
Well, right? It's a mirror. I mean, yeah, it's exactly the same principle.
And this was the World Jewish Congress in 1883.
Right. And remember that, you know, when you get like the American Jewish Committees, you know, the authoritarian personality, who's putting this out? I mean, this is the Frankfurt School. They got hired by the American Jewish Committee. So, again, it's one of these things I really think people should go and study, is that they have of all of the, you know, we have the fascism scale, which is this crackpot psychological scale to determine if a personality is prone to become a fascist. Mm-hmm. Right. This complete crackpot, but this is the stuff they were generating. But in addition to that, they developed the ethnocentric scale. Now, this is absolutely hilarious because, I mean, basically they're determining how much ethnic awareness a European has. And let me tell you, this scale is completely focused on European ethnicity, because it isn't trying to determine if someone has a Jewish identity as a neurosis. You see?
Yeah.
This is not the Eurocentric issue, the problem, the thing that we need to like develop psychological scales to determine if it exists. So this is the thing. They don't even see their ethnic pride as even having any possible negative context. It's literally like it's a static thing in the world. It just exists. It's never going away. So just deal with it. But the European, now they're malleable. They can, you know, we can turn them in, you know, to fairy tale animals or change their sexuality. See, they have this idea that they can manipulate the psychology of Europeans. It's justified. And this didn't occur. Something wasn't new following the Holocaust. Just look at what Luchas did in 1920s in Hungary, and you can see it's an exact model of what then becomes Disneyland and Hollywood in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, the Holocaust is just the grand excuse they use to engage in this type of behavior. They can even make up Holocaust stories in the name of the Holocaust.
Of course.
I mean, the case was Elie Wiesel, who claimed there was a PBS special movie called The Liberators about this, black soldiers that liberated Buchenwald. It turns out the whole thing was just made up. But he has this elaborate quote how he cried when the black soldiers, he saw the black soldiers emerge mighty from their tanks, and I cried, and the soldiers cried. We both cried together. This is all made up. Elie Wiesel. Just like his book Night, it was all a fantasy.
Completely insane. I mean, you know, it's like the thing, you know, don't want to get into this Holocaust denial situation, Tim, but I will point out that the shrunken heads,
yes,
and the human lampshade light fixture are completely absurd and are obvious propaganda devices to try to create a kind of genre, right, which is the Holocaust inducing guilt because there was such, these depravities were occurring. And it casts a question over all of the data point concerning the Holocaust, which, of course, the normal researcher would ask when you see that Edward Bernays' nephew is a person in charge of the Nuremberg trial, and that the whole way that Europe and America learns about this insanity inside of the German people is through Ewan Cameron.
Yes.
Who was the MKUltra psychopath that would put people into chemical comas for a month and give them electroshock to get rid of their memory and occasionally kill them. It would just be irrelevant. So you see, this whole thing just stinks.
Yeah, I was reading about Deborah Lipstadt and her run-in with various run-ins with so-called deniers, and of course she had that famous case when she was sued by, what's his name, David Irving, and she apparently she of course, she targets Holocaust deniers all the time. That's her kind of her thing, I guess, as an academic. But she, for a while in her course, in a book, had a book that had her students read called Fragments. And of course, Fragments is a book about it, so by a supposed Holocaust survivor. Well, it turns out the book was written not only by a non-Jew, but someone who actually was born after the Holocaust.
Well, you know, it's like one of the...
Yeah, it's a complete fabrication, but she says... Yeah. She finally admitted that, and she goes, well, it's still useful as a novel.
God.
At which point you're thinking, okay, there's such bad faith here, such dishonesty here. So when you are a Holocaust denier, what does that mean? Are you just questioning certain aspects of the narrative? Half the narrative? Are you saying that might be exaggerated for political reasons, perhaps, or financial reasons? Does this make you a denier? I mean, does it make you a denier to claim that a German suffered too? In their estimations, it does. If you point out that the communists were guilty of crimes as equal, if not worse, than the Third Reich, does it make you a denier? I mean, that whole term is, again, just, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's sort of like when you look at the whole Holodomor, destruction of the Ukrainian, which was overseen by Yagoda, a Jewish guy.
Mm-hmm.
You can see photographs of his Masonic troops with their, you know, all of them with their hand inside their vest, you know, giving that Masonic hand signal, right? And then you look at the number. I mean, the Holocaust has the famous 6 million number. I mean, this would just be a fraction of the people that got killed in this process. And then you go, well, at least the U.S. would know about this, right? The Europeans would be alerted. Well, actually not, because you see, the New York Times had Durante, the reporter over there,
mm-hmm.
and he was covering it up, right?
And he still hasn't surrendered his award.
He was given the Pulitzer Prize, so it's just sort of like, you know.
But which is ironic, because who was Joseph Pulitzer?
Right, yeah.
You know, he was a yellow journalist.
Right, of course he was. So this is, of course, actually deserves a yellow journalist.
It does, yeah. It's very fitting.
But you see, this is the thing, is that, you know, it's like I've said, Tim, you know, the only thing about where we are that is really true is that we don't know where we are. We have not a clue.
Well, I mean, look, I'm going to...
History is taken away from us, and our history is fake.
Yeah, I concede that regardless of what aspect of the Holocaust narrative I accept, or whether it's exaggerated, if I reject it, I'm critical of it. I concede that the SS was a nasty operation. Okay, it was a nasty operation.
100%.
100%.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so the fact it was made up of 90% Germans. So is there some German collective guilt for that? I say there is, because they're still paying the German state, taxing German citizens to pay reparations for the so-called Holocaust. Well, the Cheka in the Ukraine was 80% Jewish.
Yeah.
Is there any collective guilt for that?
Yeah, I mean, and is there any collective Jewish guilt for the whole Holodomor? No, there isn't, because they shape history their way. That's why, you know, I just think
NKVD. I always admit there's Cheka NKVD. But I'm saying is these organizations, the Bolshevik Party,
was
financed
very,
by who?
Right. Well, that's right. And
run,
but the
by
thing
who,
is, that, yeah, is that the right approach is not to even let the argument go into whether or not the Holocaust existed. To me, the right argument is, I'm sorry, I just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
It is. I'm not going to let you use it as a kind of a political, you know, ratchet to change my ability to think clearly today.
Well, the whole damn war was a Holocaust.
Yeah, everything was a
Holocaust.
Come on,
60 million.
You know,
Dresden was a literal Holocaust.
Yeah,
Holocaust.
You can look. History has many claims regarding it.
Mm-hmm.
They can believe anything they want about the Holocaust. I mean, how could this be proved or disproved?
Well, unfortunately, history is a carnal, it's a slaughterhouse.
And yeah, that's what it's really. But anyway, the point is.
And from that, you can derive a lot of narratives for whatever advantage you want to seek.
I would say the same thing to someone who would be asking me to judge the attempts by, you know, the Israeli citizens to defend themselves in the light of Jewish guilt over the Holodomor. As I would to, you know, someone trying to get me to use the Holocaust as a system of thinking, so that I would, you know, basically, you know, promote Jewish, influence and success today.
Well, I was talking to an Irish guy a while back. And he was talking how apparently there's a Jewish organization lecturing the Irish because they don't have a Holocaust memorial.
Oh, no.
And he said, well, is there a memorial for the Irish for the potato famine in Israel?
Yeah, good question. And particularly when you look at the Masonic connections into the potato famine, you really wonder if maybe they should be a little guilty about some of that, you know. And so,
yes.
Look,
Palmerston.
it's obviously no matter how you slice it, it's ad hominem. I mean, it's not good analytic thinking to use historical. You know, situations to like help us understand today and make decisions. Look, you got to make your case based on what is real at the moment. This should be the first step, and whether or not there's historical principles that have some meaning, that would be down line. That would be something that would enter into the debate later on. Right now, we have a situation where in Dickinson, Texas, if you want funds to rebuild your house, you have to agree to suspend your First Amendment rights in terms of any kind of boycott of Israel.
The silence is deafening on that.
Right. That's right. And the media is afraid, I would characterize them as afraid because they're not speaking out. But this should not be, something that the suspension of the First Amendment should not be something that is coherent because of the Holocaust.
Yeah, is the conduct of the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, or the Mossad, or the policies of the Likudnik government in Israel and Tel Aviv, is that a subject for legitimate debate?
Well, is a boycott of Israel a subject for legitimate debate? No, I'm afraid not. It's against the damn law. not if you want to get your home rebuilt. You have to suspend the First Amendment.
Well, listen, I asked the same question. Is the debate over something as complex as certain aspects of the Second World War, which is a very complex event, is that a legitimate discussion for academia, for history, for just people? Yes, but then again, what do we have?
Well, you know, let me just phrase that. It always cracks me up. It's such a good question. Because, you know, you have the Holocaust, and you've got this really tarring of the psychic of the German people, right? There's just so many components to that. And after World War II, you have all of this, you know, this like so-called it's really just pseudo-psychology about the characterizing the German people as bad. Crazy. Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, until I brought it up, have you ever heard or seen anyone mention the fact that, you know, the guy who's bringing this information is Ewan Cameron? and I mean, he's the guy who did the psychic driving where a woman came to him, and just as an example, she was depressed because she had a postpartum depression. And he goes, I have a cure for you. Put her in a chemical coma for 30 days and gave her electroshock, right? She lost all memory, which was the plan. And then this turned out to be something. It was actually an experiment, right? It was an experiment. So this should be in every, you know, Holocaust discussion concerning the legitimacy of the information about this episode that is being, you know, on the table in like our political context. It should be something that people talk about. No one has ever even brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever brought it up. Something so obvious, so clear cut. So there's something wrong. I mean, we know what it is. They're just intimidated. And because they're intimidated, they're either intimidated or they're aggressive because they're promoting these things, or they're intimidated because they're like some kind of a Gentile that doesn't have he's afraid of getting fired. But at the end of the day, the thinking is in the toilet because nobody is able to like just bring up the obvious truths about this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So here in Dickinson, I would hope that people who are who realize that the Constitution is needed now more than ever, right? Because when people are trying to take it away, that's usually a time when you need it.
Yes.
And they would say, you know what? We got to clean this mess up. We have to identify the politicians that brought this suspension of the First Amendment. We have to identify them. We've got to get rid of them. And we have to figure out what influenced them, right? This is what you have to do in Texas right now. You need to find out who they are, where the money came from, what were they afraid of. I would try to do interviews with them. Just call them up on the damn phone, just the people who voted for it, and just say, what made you vote for this crazy suspension of the First Amendment? Start getting some of this stuff on record and then take it out to the public and go, look, Texans, we're losing our First Amendment here with this process. You know.
Yeah, I mean, Governor Abbott down there, this should be, do you want a governor that has no regard for the First Amendment or a government that has higher regard for the state of Israel than he does for the First Amendment? Because last time I checked, he didn't swear an oath to the Israeli state. He swore an oath to uphold and defend the state constitution of Texas and also the U.S. Constitution, the United States Constitution. And he's not doing that.
Yeah.
You know, he's serving. And it's funny. I saw the photograph. There's a in that video that Aaron and Melissa Dykes posted. They have a video of him signing the actual law. And behind him is the Israeli flag.
Well, it's very appropriate.
At least it's a little honesty there, I suppose. But geez, that's...
I mean, he wasn't standing on a copy of the Constitution, was he?
Yeah, it was yeah.
I mean, it's just the symbolism is you know, is transparent. But you know, it's just democracy is not a piece of paper; it's the actions of citizens. And this is a moment where you need to be brave. You have to stay if you believe that the First Amendment is worthwhile. And trust me, you want freedom of speech. It isn't much of a country without that. You got to just stand up for it.
Yeah, and right now, I mean, obviously, right now they're not going to execute that clause because the last thing they want is a test case, or the publicity that it would create. Theoretically, of course,
it would backfire on. Yeah. It would backfire. But see, this is what the people in tech, because you know how they are, Tim. They'll creep this stuff in incrementally. You get used to it. It's normal. This is just how we are. And oh, yeah. And then after 10 years, then people start to accept it. Now, if you want the First Amendment to stand up and do something and mean something, you've got to defend it aggressively. And the way to do it is to start exposing this thing. Mm-hmm. Get more and more Texans to be aware of it. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you could actually get somewhere in Texas, because they are, you know, they see themselves as, the, you know, staunchly independent.
And, yeah, Lone Star State and all that. Yeah.
So, I mean, this would be a time maybe some of that Lone Star energy might be applicable. You know, let's bring it out. Let's get something done here, because, you know, the more scary to me was the New York Magazine article.
Yeah.
About it becoming a federal law. And it's just, I mean, you know, it is not democratic, and it should be resisted.
Yeah. And of course, down at those mega churches like Hagee's, they're all they're funded by Israel through donations,
yeah,
and also by the CIA. I mean, there's a lot of intrigue with the function of those mega churches and various intelligence operations and smuggling and money laundering, things like that. So they get a lot of money. The leaders do. So it's like they're like the televangelists. It's the people in the congregation are perhaps, you know, kind of useful idiots or well-intentioned fools who think they're following the word of God by listening to these.
Yeah, I always wonder about someone like Hagee. You know, is he, I mean, what is in back of this crackpot? You know, is there actually a real mind, or is he, you know, a crypto of some kind? I mean, what in the heck is in back of this guy? Because his theology is just so ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, he's one of his projects is to breed the perfect red heifer, right? which the Book of Revelation talks about, you know. And so he's going to breed the perfect, the blemishless red heifer. Now, Tim, you got to remember what he's trying to bring about is what we call the apocalypse,
mm-hmm.
right? So what I would just say, look for religious leaders. And look for politicians that want to put off the apocalypse,
yes, exactly.
Rather than those that are trying to bring it about. You see, this would be, I think, a good guiding principle for, you know, your
what do they call
vote ticket. You know,
is immanentizing the eschatology, as they say, or something like that? Is that what
yeah.
it is? Yeah. So they say that, you know, this is the word of God, but we can speed God up a little bit, nudge him.
Yeah, we're going to breed the red heifer and the we're going to get the apocalypse. I mean, this is it's just completely insane. But, you know, when it's not harmless, it may seem it's just a stupid bloomy. Hagee has enormous power in the Republican Party. And this kind of insanity normalizes the really worst parts of Zionism. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because when Hagee is like an extreme saying, you know, we've got to bring about, you know, the atomic war as soon as we can, then it just makes people that justify the endless wars in the Middle East as reasonable. You see,
well, he can get the votes in. It's the same way that, you know, Jim Jones could get the votes in San Francisco, and was given the People's Temple for that operation, and that was, you know. So it's, and, you know, and these the people corralled. It's all part of the dialectic. We talked about, you know, the role of British Freemasonry and ultimately in promoting not only Zionism, but the rise of National Socialism. That was part of a dialectic that was important in a certain phase in the 20th century, because they needed to destroy Russia and Germany as part of the Mackinder Doctrine. So you can, the same way that it's applied to domestic politics, where a lot of the cultural wars that we've seen in the past 50, 60 years are there to create dialectics. I mean, whether it's the promotion of gay rights or feminism, the promotion of the Playboy philosophy, these things, this is to get certain reactions, to get people to line up certain camps. But at the end of the day, we're all being forced in their various lodges of Freemasonry.
Yeah, well, I mean,
being played. It's like whether you're in the left-wing lodge or the right-wing lodge.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're serving the lodge, the Grand Lodge,
yeah. Yeah.
Which is a better explanation. But I mean, my point is, a lot of these people who will support like the mega churches and the evangelism, the evangelicals, is they're drawn to it by a lot of the cultural issues. And again, they're being played. And of course, the political process is not there to resolve these issues. It's there just to keep them going, keep the fundraising going, so we're all, you know, take up sides. Whether you take up the left wing cause or the right wing cause, and you start throwing brick and bats at it, you know, throwing bottles and using brick bats against each other, as opposed to acknowledging those who rule over us. You know, so
that's the key point, because it's just like Trump versus Clinton, mm-hmm. the presidential campaign. The candidates were created because of the hatred they would engender in those who disliked them, weren't going to vote for them.
Mm-hmm.
They had nothing to do about giving something to the people that were in favor of them. And the idea is that when you have the intense hatred, the choice seems as though there is some kind of functioning democracy.
Yeah. Right?
You can pick Hillary or Donald, and look, there may be, you know, not a great choice, but at least democracy offers you an option. But the fact is, in terms of the issues that we had brought up of the Federal Reserve and the Middle East wars and Israel, no, there isn't a choice. It's incredible.
And we have fake debate. We have
fake debate.
Stage managed political theater. And you can say, well, we're not persecuting the United States because you and I are here talking. We can go to church if we want. We can worship how we feel. We can go. We have Coke and Pepsi. You know, we have 30 different flavors of ice cream, so we're free. But the thing is, well, there's worse things than physical coercion. There's worse things than physical death or physical, you know, there's spiritual death. There's moral corruption. And why that is worse is because that actually kills the soul. And that's this type of tyranny is far more long-lasting, and it's far more sinister, but because it's not a boot on your face, it's got the velvet covering on it, but nevertheless you're still living under a boot, you know. So
slavery is most effective when the slave doesn't know he's enslaved, and mm-hmm. and you know, this is the problem that we face, is that they're able to create enough of hatred, you know, between ourselves that we don't realize that. The only, I mean, freedom to me is you have some kind of control over your currency. You have some kind of control over the federal use of violence, right? You should have, you know, control basically over your physical, physical being.
Mm-hmm.
These things are all stripped away, you know? I mean, we don't have any control. I mean, you know, it's like you were saying, like people, we have gotten used to a Federal Reserve banking system that people used to kill those who would advocate this system, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this would have led in many cases to violence, but now the American people just put up with the idea of the Federal Reserve and the primary banks taking a fee for the ownership of the credit that they invent, that they give to us.
Yeah, and if you feel increasing pressure, tension, and pain, that is the accumulating weight of compound interest.
100%. 100%. That's what is making us a poor nation every single year, is that the currency is, I mean, people say, well, gee, I'm linking, so my salary's gone up. Yeah, but the currency has been debased far greater than your increase in your salary. You just don't see the debasement, you know, because the inflation, the way that the currency is no longer working the way it did. And you know, the most obvious thing is that in the 50s, a normal job could create a ownership of a house and the wife could stay at home with the children.
Yes.
Try doing that today. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't, it's not possible. And that's there is your poverty right in your face, right? The fact that the mother has to work in order to have any kind of ownership of property. And so, you know, we are given the facade of democracy, but the reality is something totally different.
Well, and this is how monetary debasement creates cultural and moral debasement, because your options are narrowed. If you can't save, if your employment situation isn't stable, you can't save money, you become increasingly desperate for employment, which means you're manipulated easier. And so that's how they kind of corral you into behaving certain ways.
And the father has less
authority. Yeah,
authority. Wait, because he has to share the income responsibility with the wife.
Yeah, and there's no one at home. And there's no one at home.
Right, and the state fills in the void in terms of control over the minds of the children, and so
with easy credit and pornography.
Yeah, exactly.
And easy credit is just more debt.
Yeah, so you have the culture where your wife is working. Your children are being educated by pornographers and cultural Marxists, but you're okay because you got to vote for Trump.
Yep, you have to go to Trump. And if you're a female and you're pretty and you can't find a good job, you can always go to Hollywood and meet Harvey Weinstein.
Right, that's right.
Search of stardom and fame.
Weinstein. Yeah, and so anyway, this is a critical situation, and the episode in Dixon, Texas is just one example of it. Yeah. You know, let's organize and fight back. The hell with this crap.
Yep. Okay, Joe, I think we covered it well, you think?
Tim, I think it was covered more than well. It was covered wonderfully.
Okay, well, I think we'll both be on the – if we won't get Christmas cards from Abe Foxman, the ADL, this year.
No, but so. I wasn't expecting any anyway, you know. I don't know why. You think that they would really like independent thinkers like you and me, but somehow they just don't. I don't know.
Listen, Joe, thanks a lot. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.